Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Boy, lots of fun things to talk about this morning. I said I was going to talk about romaine lettuce, and we're going to come back and talk about this. It's an interesting subject, and from a lot of perspectives. It says something about why we eat what we eat, where we can eat what we eat, and I'm going to talk a little bit about it. It reminds me of a few things if we get a chance. If not, we'll talk about it another day. But it's a fun subject, and it's timely, and I know that people are a little freaked out about it. Robert, thank you for calling. I'm listening. You there, Robert?
Oh, this is Tony, Bill.
Oh, Tony. Good. Let's go with Tony. Tony, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, I wanted to tell you, you know, last week you told me how to make the best turkey sandwich.
Yeah.
By taking the mustard leaf.
That's right.
Well, that's exactly what I did, and you were right.
Isn't that good?
My goodness, that was good.
Isn't that good? And it just like, you almost forget you're eating turkey. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah, and if it's all right with you, I'm just going to keep calling that plant a tractor seed plant.
That's fine. Well, yeah. It deserves a pretty name, too. But tractor seed plant is, I see where you got it. I see. Have you heard other people call it that?
Well, I got it from Oliver, and that's what they called it. And when he said that, and I looked down, I'm like, man, it does. It looks like an old-timey tractor seed.
Well, it's a funny name. I haven't seen that. I haven't heard that before, but that plant has had a lot of naming issues over the years. Even though we've grown it, the spotted one was the one first. The one you have is Farfugium japonicum. The actual name for it in the trade is Giganteum or Gigantea. The giant Farfugium is the one because it has really big, really big glossy leaves, really pretty.
Oh, it sure is.
Put it in the ground, and those leaves will get even bigger if it's happier.
Well, that's what I wanted to do. That's why I, text you the questions, because I really did want to put it in the ground, but I was scared, it would get, frozen or cold, and of course we'd lose it.
So. Cold's not a problem. Cold is not a problem at all, but wet ground is a problem. Nematodes may be a problem too. So lots of organic matter will help.
Okay.
So lots of organic matter is going to help in both cases. So,
and what about fertilizer to put on it? What do you recommend?
No, I wouldn't even worry about the fertilizer.
If
you've got plenty of organic matter, it's going to be just fine.
Okay. Well, I appreciate you talking about it. That's great, and thank you for the info on the turkey sandwich.
Yeah, good. I'm glad to hear it. So if y'all don't know what Tony's talking about, let me just tell him, Tony. What we talked about is growing the Japanese red lettuce, the giant red, it's called. Very big, beautiful, pleated leaves that don't look like tractor seats. They look like a big red plume that's pleated. It's really weird looking, but beautiful lettuce. Great ornamental grown at Bellengrath, but actually delicious. Really spicy. But if you like mustard at all, if you like just, like spreadable mustard, it has that just top-of-the-nose feel to it. And you put it on a sandwich, it's like a combination of horseradish and mustard all at the same time, but not too strong. And do it instead of lettuce. It is absolutely beautiful. Yep, that's it. Hey, Robert, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, sir. I hope you had a nice Thanksgiving.
I did.
I bought some Merlotons at Rouse's supermarket, and they claimed they came from Louisiana. And I wondered if I could plant that from the seeds inside the Merlotons.
Well, yeah, I strongly suspect, I'll take your advice on this if you're listening. David, who's our expert on Merloton, I strongly suspect that the people at Rouse's are wrong, that they are not from Louisiana, that they're probably from Mexico or South or Central America. I don't know of any big melaton plantations in Louisiana right now. I would be shocked if they were growing enough to distribute to grocery stores everywhere. But maybe there are. We'll see. Maybe, but I kind of doubt it. What I think they're thinking at Rouse's is, oh, people in Louisiana use this a lot, and we see it all the time in Louisiana, and people there use it for cooking all the time, and people in Louisiana grow it, and they don't realize that it actually came from Mexico and South America. So, so the other thing we're referencing with Robert, Robert understands this and appreciates this, and that's why he called. We've talked about before that the Central American strains of melaton don't do as well for us as the Gulf Coast strains. So that's why we're getting John Olive and a lot of other people to develop these Gulf Coast strains. I don't think – you can try it. You can certainly try it. This is a big thing to try because they get really big. But you can try it and see what happens. Don't put it outside right now or you really will be wasting your time. They don't – they'll need to put it in a – a lot of people put – just put the melaton with that little the little cleaved end, the little, you know, that funny end that's kind of looks like it's split. They put it halfway in the ground with that on the bottom and just let it root there. And that's how a lot of people do it. And leave it inside, let it root out inside, and then it'll be ready to plant out next year.
So you plant the whole melaton?
Yeah, that's right. You plant the whole thing. You don't take the skin off. You don't take the seed is in there, but you don't do anything to. You just leave.
I'll be darned.
Plant the whole thing.
What's the best time to put it outside?
Put it outside in late March.
Okay, and you can start it now in a pot, or just
that's right. You can start it now in a pot. And it'll start getting roots on it, and
just plant the little mouth looking part down.
That funny little mouth part should be down. I can't say what it looks like, but you know it. So there it is. It's like two cheeks, and
yeah.
So David is driving. And but he is kind enough to text in, which I'm sure he did by voice. and David says every time he's checked at Rouse's, they're from Mexico.
Yeah, okay.
So, you know, you could try it, but it's probably not going to do as well as the ones from Louisiana.
Where could I get that local Gulf Coast strain?
Well, we're working on it. I don't know whether John got enough this year to sell at the Botanical Gardens or not. We continue to build it up. Keep listening because David Hubble is doing a great job for us. He's working with us a lot on a lot of things. Working not with us. David's doing his own thing. But we talk about it a lot, and David is growing out a lot of these plants. He's doing what he can. There's sort of a movement to get melatons reestablished on the Gulf Coast. So I'm going to talk to David about it. We'll kind of get a feel for whether how many of these we're going to have next spring. I think we're still in a position where we're all trying to help each other by growing these out so that other people can have them. But let's check. Stay in touch with us, Robert. And let's make you one of the melaton growers here along the Gulf Coast.
Okay, and they're full sun, right?
Yeah, they like a lot of sun. A lot of sun, and you know they just grow and grow and grow and grow and grow. They get really big, you know, 30 feet vines easily.
Do you have to have something for them to grow on?
It certainly helps. It's going to be very hard to maintain them if you don't, because the grass is going to grow up through them and it's going to get kind of weedy and you don't know how to cut around them. So it certainly helps to have a trellis or something for them to grow on.
Okay. Well, I appreciate it, and I'll check back later.
All right. A good fence works pretty well, too.
Okay. Right.
All right. Good to hear from you, Robert.
Right.
Hey Kevin, thanks for being persistent. I'm listening. What's up?
No problem. I do appreciate your show, and I just had a question about iron plants.
Yes, sir.
I've got, I guess I transplanted a bunch from my home town of Baton Rouge, brought them over, and they did great. Everything's fine. Put them around some houses that I have, and they do great. But the problem that I have is that some of them just look poorly. They look yellow. You know, they get tattered looking, and others just are beautiful, bright, you know, or dark green. And just want to know, there's obviously something different. I know that you can't put them in any kind of sun, and these are the ones that are doing poorly are you know, almost full shade. Is there some type of, do I need to put extra nitrogen in the soil, or what do you recommend?
Yeah, I think they'll look better if they're in full shade and they're looking poorly. I think actually they'll do better. They're probably having a little problem competing with the trees around them. And this is and by shade, I assume you mean not the shade of a house, but the shade of a tree?
Tree, yes. I've got a lot of rows of trees that block most of the sun.
Yeah, I think they'll do fine there, actually, in the long run. One of the interesting things about iron plant, cast iron plant, if those of you don't know, Aspidistra, kind of a, you see it around old houses a lot. It's got, there are a lot of great varieties. There are actually some with speckled leaves and striped leaves and all sorts of really cool varieties of it. But even the old-fashioned green one can be very nice. I recommend about every 2 years going in and just practically speaking, cut everything back to the ground.
Damn.
In early spring. And did I scare you? You still there? Kevin?
Yeah, I'm still here. I'm still here.
Yeah. I didn't know what. So at any rate, I would cut it back to the ground about every 2 to 3 years and just let it come on. Fertilize it a little bit with cottonseed meal. Water it really good. And you'll get these fresh green leaves that look really nice. Going in and trying to clean out each tattered leaf gets to be a real problem. So kind of look at it. Maybe you could go every 3 years, but it sounds to me like your clump is getting a little tattered. Just cut it to the ground. It'll spring back. Don't do it now if you don't want. Wait until spring to do it. February would be a great time. Early February, cut that thing to the ground, mid-February. Cut it to the ground, give it a little bit of cottonseed meal. Cottonseed meal would be perfect.
Okay.
And water it.
How long will it take to come back if you cut it, say, in February?
Well, you know, it's going to put up leaves that are going to be, they're going to look, the leaves are going to be very long. They're going to develop their full size pretty quickly. So I would say it's going to look pretty full again by the 1st of April.
Okay. So just. Mid-February, cut them back, and then in April, you're looking to a couple months, probably.
Okay. Yeah, it's a month and a half. So they're gonna respond really nicely, and they'll look good. They may not be quite as tall in April, but they'll be really thick, and then by June, they're definitely going to be as thick as they were before you cut them back, and probably thicker.
Fantastic. I do appreciate it, but cottonseed meal is the best.
Yeah, cottonseed meal is the easiest thing to manage because you know it's – yes. Let me just say yes. I won't tell you why. I'll just say yes. There's some other things you could use, but cottonseed meal is the easiest one to manage.
Okay, great.
All right.
Well, thank you so much.
All right, great, Kevin. Good to hear from you. We got to take a break, but we're going to be back with some more thoughts on melitol. Thanks to David.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? Come on, tell me, baby. In the pond, where the sun don't ever shine. I was shivering all night too.
Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Blaine Gardening. It's sweet gum Sunday morning, excuse me, here along the Gulf Coast. It's just, you know, I like sweet gums. It reminds me of being here. it's the kind of thing, seeing a sweet gum, is the kind of thing, the color of sweet gum, that beauty of sweet gum in the fall, is something that really can only be appreciated in the Deep South where sweet gum are native. You know, you can plant sweet gums farther north, and people have, certainly outside of their native range, not too much because they're a little sensitive to cold if you get up into New England. But, you know, it's not the same as having them be such a part of the woods here and such a part of the scenery. Beautiful trees. And as we said, sweet gums actually stand up to hurricanes quite well. There's probably a lot of reasons for that. You know what? It's not the best of trees for standing up to hurricanes. And it won't stand up to every hurricane because no tree will. But they're pretty good. They're pretty good trees. I don't think every yard should have a sweet gum, but boy, it's nice to see the sweet gums when you see them. They're just absolutely beautiful. Sweet gum Sunday because the colors right now are very rich. Brian saw some Japanese maples, and we've got some great maples. Brian, I got to pause. I got to talk about it. There's some great native maples, and they're looking great in the woods right now. I've been seeing them all through Alabama, Monroe County right now. The maples are just great. We have some great native maples, a lot more native maples than most places. But we have chalky bark maple, the chalky bark maple, the white-skinned maple, however you want to call it, chalky maple. The southern sugar maple is absolutely stunning right now. Both of those two maples are absolutely gorgeous right now, and they're pretty common. We'll see them both. You'll see both of those at Blakely on the bluffs there. Probably there's actually some sugar maples left even on the western shore bluffs, real part of our tree heritage here. The southern sugar maple group, the chalky bark maple and the southern sugar maple. Red maples, Drummond red maple, has probably mostly lost its leaves right now, but it's stunning in the swamps. Just incredible. Some of the greatest color you see in the swamps is actually the Drummond red maple. Just beautiful stuff, incredibly red. Drummond maple. It's different than the northern red maple, a very distinctive variety. Drummond red maple, not long lived in your yard, but boy, is it beautiful in the swamps. Great thing. So great maples are great. But Brian saw some Japanese maples in Birmingham, and there's a lot of color, and there are a lot of varieties of Japanese maples that do well here. And, you know, I am so good. I remember every variety of Japanese maple that does good here. I don't. I just don't. I don't remember them off the top of my head. I have to look them up. I have to go back and think about them. There are other things that are in my head besides every Japanese maple variety, but boy, there are a lot of them that do well here, and there are a lot of them that don't do well here. How do you know to pick which one? Well, let me go and say that the Mobile Botanical Gardens, through Martin Vandergeusen and Bobby Green and some other folks who have been selecting these maples for a long time, they have picked the maples that do very well for us. So Mobile Botanical Gardens always has those. If you go to if you go to one of our local nurseries, ask them for selections from Bobby Green or Martin Vandergeusen. They both have very good red maples for our climate, for our environment, and if they can get from those two guys, you know that they've been selected. I will try my best to remember, Brian, some of those Japanese maple varieties. I can't. It's one of the problems of doing a show spontaneously and live is that I can't remember everything. I mean, there's Bloodgood is one of the common ones. And I'll think of some others. Most of the Formosa varieties that are derived from Formosa do very well here. So I'll have to think about them, but I can't think of them all right now. But Mobile Botanical Gardens, that selection process is out there. There you go. Earl, I'm listening. What's up?
Hey, Bill, how you doing?
Good.
I got a couple of different questions.
Yes, sir.
One is what's good to do with the firewood thing?
Earl, say it one more time. I kind of lost you.
My firewood.
You're breaking up, Charlie. Could you hear that?
We're just not getting a good cell signal, Earl.
Try it again, Earl. Can say it one more time. It's just bad cell signal.
Fireplace ashes.
Fireplace ashes. Ah, got it. What do you do with them?
I throw it out in the yard and I throw it around the fence.
That's fine. And so it's good. Here's fireplace ashes. I cherish fireplace ashes in our climate. Fireplace ashes raise the pH pretty fast, which is unusual. They can raise the pH. That's good in some ways. And for our climate, that's a good thing. They have a lot of potassium in them as well as some other minerals. So if you use fireplace ashes, you actually don't need to add any potassium to the soil because they've got so much. They have a little teeny tiny bit of nitrogen. But they're really good, really good. I love them to put them on my garden. I use fireplace ashes mostly instead of lime. And that's the truth. So as long as you're not putting on too much, because too much of anything can be a bad thing, as long as you're not putting on too much. Now, let me, Earl, also break in with one exception. Okay. Azaleas and blueberries and camellias and gardenias and sourwoods, they're all members of a group of plants most of them are members of a group of plants that are called ericaceous. They're plants that don't like limey soils. They don't like a high pH. They like a pH closer to 5 rather than a pH closer to 6.5. Those plants don't want lime. So don't put the lime around the blueberries. Don't put it around the azaleas. Don't put it around the camellias. Don't put it around the gardenias. And if you like blue hydrangeas, if you like your hydrangea flowers blue, don't put it around the hydrangeas. It will turn those flowers pink.
Okay.
But everywhere else, it's just fine. And normal fireplace burning here, you're just fine to put it. I put on, I've got a row. If I've got a row, here's how much I apply to my vegetable garden. I've got a row, let's say it's about 16 feet long and about 2 feet wide. I'll take a bucket, like a 2-gallon bucket of fireplace ashes, and just spread it on there.
Okay.
And that's about how much. I mean, it's not too precise. It doesn't need to be too precise as long as you got plenty of leaves and other organic matter going into that soil. But that's about how much I add. If you're putting it on the lawn, kind of spread it out pretty good. Don't let it clump up anywhere, and you'll be just fine. Ooh, that one's tough to hear. Try it again, Earl. Good for throwing in a compost pile, I think I heard. It's okay. It's okay to put it in the compost pile. I don't compost in a traditional – I don't compost the Boston way because I don't live in Boston. So I don't actually have a separate compost pile. Everything I compost is right in the garden. And that's the best way to do it. We can talk about that sometime. But, you can put it there. Some people say it's not great to put it in compost. I don't know. But I just spread it out where I want plants to grow, and that's the best way to do it. But, you could probably put it in your compost, and it's probably not going to make a lot of difference.
Okay. One more question.
Yeah, you got to say it real clearly because we're losing your signal. I'm listening.
One more question.
Yes, sir. Ooh, we lost you then. Say it one more time.
What's the best kind of garlic?
Earl, find me a better signal. Call me back. I'm not hearing you real well. We got to take a break, Charlie. Ooh. Hey, Earl, try that again, but find a better signal because I'm just. You're barely hearing you.
All the tea in China.
Put it in a big... Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hey, welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. And it's Sweet Gum Sunday morning, I need to tell you as well. And just a reminder that to go out and check out a sweet gum. Look at the color. Look at every color in that sweet gum. It's absolutely amazing how many different colors there are in a sweet gum. Hey, I want to say real quickly, David sent me a message. David Hubble sent me a message. For those of you who are interested in growing melaton, there's a great website. It's called melaton.org, and I have to spell it for you because I'm just going to spell it for you. M-I-R-L-I-T-O-N. It looks like Mirliton or Merliton. Mirliton.org. 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 If you're interested in growing melaton, this traditional Gulf Coast plant, David, there's actually an article by David on that website that tells you a little bit about his experience trying to grow melatons here using grocery store melatons and how he found the light. He came to the light. And he tells you the problems that develop from growing the grocery store melatons, which are not our melatons. They don't fruit early enough. They don't develop early enough. The Gulf Coast melaton is a different, slightly different animal, and it's different enough that it's important to us if we want to grow it. And it also connects you with growers who are growing them and selling them, the traditional Louisiana Gulf Coast melaton. This is a site devoted to Louisiana melaton. Gulf Coast, we're going to call them Gulf Coast melaton. Gulf Coast melaton. Hey, Earl. Thanks for trying us again. Boy, it was hard to hear you that first time around.
I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
I was asking the second question, what is the best kind of garlic to buy down there and plant?
Yeah, so that's easy, and it's going to be hard to find garlic this late. But
they don't have it at the botanical garden?
No, not this year. And there's not really a constant. Usually you can try to get garlic, and it may be possible to still buy garlic. You'll probably have to order it by mail.
Okay.
When I used to work there full time, I was the force behind the garlic. It's a little bit of a pain to do. Nobody ever made any money on it. Everybody was kind of grumpy about it. But I said, I want to provide garlic to folks. It's hard to do that garlic distribution thing now for a lot of reasons. But you can buy it directly by mail by going to Fillory Garlic Farm. Look up, and I don't have their website right off the top of my head, but it's Fillory, F-I-L-A-R-E-E. And if you look up Fillory and garlic on the internet, you're going to go to their catalog. And you can order garlic from them. It's getting late, but they may have some varieties left. Earl, let me tell you, they've got a lot of different garlic varieties. The only ones that have done well for me here on the Gulf Coast are the turban garlics, T-U-R-B-A-N. Not all the turbans did well, but most of them did well. If you can find Thai Fire or Thai Purple left, they're both very good garlic varieties for us. And there's some others. Blossom is good and some others. But they do well because they produce before we get to our rainy season. If your garlic is still trying to bulb up in June by June 15th and in June 30th, it's gonna hit that rainy season, and it's gonna mess it up. It's gonna wipe it out. It's gonna want to resprout. It's the ugliest looking garlic I've ever seen. If you don't harvest it, you want to be able to harvest that garlic in May while it's still dry. So that's why the turbans work really well for us.
Okay.
So look for those turbans. Next year, start a little bit earlier. And in case you can get a better variety. September is a good time to order garlic.
All right. I sure do appreciate it.
All right, Earl. Good to hear from you, as always.
Thank you.
Danny, I'm listening. What's up?
Yes, sir. I got some satsumas, and I really don't know what the hell they are, but they're about the size of a softball. What is that?
Well, they're a... Well, they're a Satsuma. We got that down. You know, well, most of them are about the size. The size of the Satsuma has a lot to do with how many Satsumas are on the tree, whether it's a young tree or an old tree.
It's an old tree, and I got a bunch on there.
Yeah. So it's probably a wari. It's probably a wari. O-W-A-R-I. It could be Brown Select. It could be some others. But given the fact that there's given the maturity time and given the fact that it's pretty old, you've had it for a long time, it's probably Owari. O-W-A-R-I. Does that help?
Yeah, and another thing on the fertilizing, people are calling in talking about cottonseed meal. I put triple 13 in February and then in July.
You can
triple
do that.
13, a couple Mardi Gras cups all the way around the drip line, and it just seems like it does wonders.
You can do that. There's a problem. There's one problem with triple 13 that I'll tell you about. The fact is that it's got that middle number is high, and that's phosphorus. And the phosphorus builds up and can become toxic after a while if you're not careful. Because it doesn't, it literally overwhelms the plant, because the phosphorus, unlike the two other, there are three numbers there, 13, 13, 13. The 13 on either end, nitrogen and potassium, they leach out of the soil quickly. Phosphorus doesn't, and the plant doesn't need that much phosphorus. And so the phosphorus keeps building up to the point that it begins to tie up iron and other and other things. So too much phosphorus can be bad. That's why 13, 13, 13 isn't a great thing. If I were going to do it, I would try to look for something that was more like, if you could find 13, 13, 0, 13, that would be ideal. But, and I doubt it's out there, but something like 12, 12, 0, 6 would be great. It's just that middle number is high, and over time it can build up and cause problems. Now, you know, you may not be putting enough on there for it to cause problems, but it's not a good thing. And my friend and an expert on many things to do with trees, Chris Francis, sends me a note, a little nudge, and says, just sent me a note saying triple anything is not a good long-term solution. And that's the problem, is long-term triple 10, triple 13, because that first number, that middle number is so high, it can be a problem.
Well, I can tell you who turned me on to it. I was doing a job down in Empire, Louisiana, where there's satsumas on the left, orchards on the right, and just everywhere. And I asked them about it, and they told me that's what they did. It was triple 13, but their soil down there may be different than ours.
Well, it's not, and it's probably worse there than it is here. But, in fact, one of the problems is that growers were using triple 13 because that's what everybody had been doing, and that's what Granddaddy did, and that's what Papa did, and that's what everybody was going to keep doing because that's what they had been doing. And they were having problems with their citrus, and they brought or with their lawns or with other things. And they brought experts in, and they said, "Well, guys, you got so much phosphorus in your soil that it's actually causing problems." So long term, there was a toxic buildup of that phosphorus. So we now know this, and it's not as bad as some things, but it can be a problem after a while. So you know, you can probably get by with it if you don't do too much. But in general, you want that middle number to be lower. And you can do it however you want to. I just don't want other folks to think that it's a good idea to use triple 13.
Well, all right, man. I certainly appreciate it.
All right. Danny, good to hear from you. Chris says, you know, and Chris points out, when you're using something like triple 13, when you're using a chemical fertilizer for a long period of time, I don't worry about it too much if you've got organic matter and other things. But if you're not using a lot of organic matter, you're using a chemical fertilizer for a long time that's got a lot of built-in chemicals. Chris has got to run, keep him straight, he says. All right. If you're using a chemical fertilizer that is or an artificial fertilizer, an artificially made fertilizer, you probably need to do a soil test because you don't know what it's doing to the soil. I'm not big on soil samples in every case, but if you're using triple 13 a lot, you better check because I suspect your phosphorus levels are out of the roof. Out of the roof, and that can create real problems. And Charlie is tired of hearing me talk about triple 13, so he's going to cut me off right now. But you know what? I'm going to be back.
Plain gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
If you'll call me on the Sweet Gum Sunday morning, I hope you'll enjoy the sweet gum trees. I hope you'll enjoy them because they're awful beautiful right now. It's this Gulf Coast treat. We were talking about triple 13, triple 8, triple 10, all these triple fertilizers that were that after the 40s became traditional in the South because we could manufacture it and thought, well, you know, a little good bunch might be better. Well, it wasn't. Listen, here's what happens when you use a triple anything product. It puts too much phosphorus in the ground. And citrus are a great case. So there was problems with citrus yellowing leaves, trees not thriving well. What happens with the phosphorus? And this happens even with citrus trees. In fact, it's been a big problem for citrus in some places. Is the phosphorus ties up zinc and iron. And iron is very important for plants. Zinc is important. Iron is very important. Most trees need a lot of iron. Most shrubs need a lot of iron. And when you add that phosphorus, if you were doing that for things like, gosh, it just creates a huge problem. You know, one of the reasons I think longleaf pines, by the way, and I'm just going to say this, longleaf pines have had a real problem getting established on old cattle farms and old pastures and old fields. And one of the reasons they've had a problem, I suspect, has to do with excess phosphorus in those soils. And that's tying up iron. And trees love iron. And they need that iron. Now, you don't want to add extra iron. No, don't take it that way, because that's not going to help, because the phosphorus is actually tying up what iron is in the soil. There's plenty of iron in the soil. There should be plenty there, but phosphorus creates problems when you add too much. And they used to have, this Bloombuster fertilizer, worst thing in the world. Oh, and I'm going to say that, and somebody's going to say, No, it's the worst thing in the world for anything growing in the ground. In a plant in a pot, you know, it's probably going to die of something else before the excess phosphorus kills it. Means plants in pots last a couple of years, and that's the way it goes. But I'm just telling you, beware that middle number. Jim, stop me from talking about this.
I sure will. last week when we had that frost, it was a little frost.
Yeah.
Basically what I did is I covered the peppers and the sugar cane and brought everything, all the potted plants in the house, which is something I want to ask you about.
Yes, sir.
But we have some volunteer peppers in the compost pile, and they appear to be doing all right.
Yeah.
Now, would that be because of the heat of the compost pile, you think?
Yeah, that's certainly going to help because that compost pile is releasing the heat and is doing it really well. You know, there's some peppers that will survive down to about 30 degrees easily without any burning. And some peppers come back from the roots, for me, even when the temperature gets down to around 25, 26 degrees. In fact, colder. I've actually seen them survive colder, particularly those South American peppers that I've been growing. So if you grew any Baccatums, B-A-C-C-A-T-U-M, any of the peppers that have A-J-I in front of their name, ahi, those peppers usually survive pretty cold temperatures in the winter and come back from me most years, even without covering. It's amazing. I was shocked. Now, that's in Mobile. It's interesting to me that because I did get a message from I'm trying to figure out what's happening around Georgetown and down in Grand Bay. So I think you were a little colder. Johnny down in Grand Bay, where all the cold air from Georgetown usually settles down there at Johnny's house. Johnny said I'm looking at his garden. It doesn't look like he got a lot of frost so far. So it must not have been a very heavy cold spell.
No, it really wasn't. There was just a little bit of frost on the windshield is how I knew that we even had a frost, to be honest with you.
Yeah, so...
I do have a question about the sugar cane.
Yeah.
This is my first year growing this, my first winter with it, and so on and so forth. I know I'm supposed to chop the stalks off and so on and so forth, because otherwise it'll freeze the roots. Now, here's what I plan on doing. I plan on chopping them off. Probably laying them down next to it about a foot or so, you know, away from it, and cover them with about 4 foot of leaf. Would that be good enough for them? And would I have another row of sugarcane?
Yes. So here's what I would do. You know, and here's the truth. I don't really believe. Could I be wrong about this? I don't think chopping the stalks off will cause the roots to freeze. Now, anybody who's grown sugarcane who knows better than me is free to do that. The reason the tops get chopped off is because people eat them. So they harvest them. But I've always left my tops on and not a problem. It might help to put a mulch on the roots. To put a cover of leaves over the roots so that they don't freeze. Right. But in this climate, I don't think it's going to make a difference. Anybody who's growing sugarcane, we're going to run this. I'm going to really track this down, and I'm going to talk to people about it, and I'm going to come back next week, and we're going to find out if I'm just wrong. And I may be. But I don't think it matters if you chop the tops off. Now, chopping the tops off is a good thing because you can start new sugarcane with it.
Exactly.
So cut those tops off. Cut them into pieces about, I don't know, 2 feet long so that you get a couple of little potential sprouts on it and lay them out where you want the new sugarcane to grow. And most of that will actually result in regenerated sugarcane if you go ahead and cut it now. If you wait too late and wait for it to dry out and get cold, yes, you will not be able to use those sugarcane pieces. So you need to go ahead and cut them now if you want to produce new sugarcane and put them in the ground. But the roots for the established sugarcane should be fine regardless.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
It makes a lot of sense, actually. I sent you a text about the potted plants in the east facing porch.
Yeah.
What do you think of that? Do you think the plants would be okay?
I think it's going to make a lot of difference, the fact that it's on an east facing porch. That makes all the difference in the world. Occasionally we have cold fronts that sneak around from the east. and they can be bad, but it's pretty rare. If that does and the wind will blow from the east, but that is very rare. Almost all of our fronts come in from the west, northwest, and that should be a good protected spot. At 32 degrees, I think they're going to be just fine.
But below that, because remember, this is Georgetown.
Yeah. So it's
5 degrees colder.
Yeah. So the other thing you can do is take and I'm going to do this. Just take a sheet or I'm going to take frost cloth that actually looks like shears, and I'm going to put those shears on the on the west side of my porch to block the wind. You could take those shears and put it on the north side of your porch to block the wind. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah.
And that might give you a little bit extra protection.
Okay. Well, that's where I got the mushrooms growing too, and they say that you really don't want them get down to freezing.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it'll take them longer to come out of the branches.
Right, right, right. Well, Jim, I'm running out of time.
Uh-oh.
But listen, it's good to talk to you. And Randy, boy, I wish I had time to talk to you, Randy, before we take a break, but we don't. Tax Man, collards are growing great for Tax Man. He's happy. Hey, it's Sweet Gum Sunday morning. Enjoy Sweet Gum, folks.